Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 3rd of September, these are our main stories. No delay to Britain's leaving the European Union at the end of next month, under any circumstances. That's what the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has told the public. Looming over the Bahamas and threatening the US East Coast, the deadly power of Hurricane Dorian, and how optimism gave way to hopelessness in Afghanistan, even as a peace deal with the Taliban seems in sight. Also in this podcast, it might be expensive, but polo is a game of growing popularity in Nigeria.
Polo game is a game of kings, and it's too expensive. If you want to buy a horse like Argentina, you'll buy some $15,000, $7,000. It depends on the highest quality that you get.
And why not losing on purpose got an Iranian sportsman into trouble. But first,
we will not accept any attempt to go back on our promises or scrub that referendum.
That is Boris Johnson issuing an ultimatum to Conservative rebels and opposition MPs as they prepare to further postpone Brexit, seize control of Parliament on Tuesday, and there could be a general election within weeks. The British Prime Minister says he will not, under any circumstances, ask Brussels for more time to negotiate an exit beyond October the 31st. Earlier, I asked our political correspondent Rob Watson to explain why Boris Johnson has taken this position.
The answer to that is quite simple, unlike most things to do with Brexit, and that is because he fears that a combination of opposition MPs and indeed some MPs from within his own party are about to try and pass a law that would essentially postpone Brexit until the end of January next year, unless Mr. Johnson and the European Union come to some agreement on an orderly withdrawal before the middle of next month.
And what chance is there that that legislation will get through? Because the numbers might not be there. The timing is going to be difficult, isn't it?
Now you get on to the trickier questions. I mean, the honest answer is that nobody really knows. But, I mean, it's certainly the case that in the past, a majority of MPs have indicated that if there's one thing that they're united around, it's that they don't want a no-deal Brexit. So will the government make it hard for them and use every little ruse and trick in the book? You betcha they will. But I think the Rebel Alliance, as they're being called, it's like something out of Hollywood, they also seem pretty determined.
I mean, there's so many extraordinary suggestions coming out that even if this legislation is passed, Boris Johnson might decide to ignore it. I mean, that would be not necessarily unprecedented, but extremely unusual.
It would be extremely unusual. And I suppose if people were to match that together with his decision last week to say he was prepared to suspend Parliament, you might say, well, you know, confirmation that he really is the most controversial Prime Minister that we've had in living memory, someone who's prepared to throw away the rule book. I mean, it seems, though, to me, from what we've heard in the last few hours, that the way to interpret Boris Johnson's speech is, look, if MPs were to pass legislation postponing Brexit, his more likely response would be to say, right, let's have an election. I mean, we just heard him say he didn't want an election. Well, he's got to say that because we all know that people in Britain are absolutely fed up with politics and politicians. But I think Downing Street has made it clear, you know, that he's essentially presenting MPs with an ultimatum. It's Corbyn and delays. Or me.
Third time in 4 years it would be if we go to the polls again. At the moment it looks so that the Conservatives Party might do rather better than the Labour opposition, but anything's possible, I suppose. Everything's up in the air.
Yes, and that is why, of course, it's a tremendous risk for Boris Johnson. I mean, all I can tell you is that the latest opinion polling suggests that the Conservatives would probably be the largest party, but not necessarily with a majority, which reminds me of what one political journalist tweeted, and it seemed to be a lot of truth in it, which is that, seems to me, the only solution is a general election, which may solve nothing.
That was Rob Watson. Well, politicians in Brussels are watching the fast-moving events here in London with growing concern. There are reports that the European Commission is considering classifying a no-deal British withdrawal from the Union as a major disaster, the same as earthquakes or floods. It would allow member countries to apply to receive money from the EU's Solidarity Fund. This report is by Adam Fleming.
The European Commission is considering updating its contingency measures in case the UK leaves without a deal on the 31st of October. One is adding economic damage caused by a no-deal Brexit to the criteria for the EU Solidarity Fund, which would be available to the remaining 27 member states. It's normally reserved for countries that have suffered a natural disaster. Italy received more than €1 billion of emergency aid after it was hit by a series of earthquakes in 2016 and 2017. Germany received €360 million after serious floods in 2013. The proposal is being discussed in Brussels today, but has to be signed off by European commissioners on Wednesday before it's approved by the European Parliament and the EU member states. It comes as the EU prepares to ramp up its communications about the implications of a no-deal Brexit for people, businesses and other organisations ahead of the October deadline. And while Brussels counts the potential costs, it continues to insist that the UK will suffer proportionally more.
Adam Fleming in Brussels. Hurricane Dorian has caused unprecedented devastation in the Bahamas, with five people now confirmed dead. Some 1,300 homes are also feared destroyed or damaged. The hurricane hit the northernmost island of Grand Bahama as a Category 5 hurricane, but it's since been downgraded to Category 4, with sustained winds still of up to 250 kilometres an hour. Forecasters expect Dorian will soon move dangerously close to the east coast of the United States. Christoph Strawn is a student and blogger who lives in the city of Freeport in the Bahamas.
We're boarded up and there's no power. The power's been off for maybe 12 hours now. And we're definitely in the path of the storm. The eye of the hurricane is maybe about 30 miles away from where I am. And it's expected to pass over me at some point. When, we're not sure, because it's basically stationary over the island right now. I saw earlier my neighbor's shutters, they flew off. So we're hoping that everything is fine with them and that everything stays fine with us. I've been hearing reports of flooding, extensive flooding throughout the island. I saw a video somebody recorded where the airport here is just about entirely underwater. There are a few residential areas that are underwater. The winds are pretty terrifying right now, and it's expected to be like this for at least the next 12 to 24 hours.
Well, that was Christoph Strawn. Chris Fawkes from the BBC Weather Centre told me that while winds are beginning to ease in the Bahamas, the problems are far from over.
So Hurricane Dorian, the eye of the storm, is currently on the north coast of Grand Bahama, and it's actually been across the island of Grand Bahama pretty much all day, with the winds gusting over 305 kilometres an hour. I mean, they have eased a few kilometres an hour over recent hours, and that's probably a trend that we're going to see over the coming hours, because the hurricane itself has pretty much stopped moving. And what that does is it actually cools the oceans underneath the hurricane. And so in a way, it's cutting off its own energy supply because it's not moving.
It's interesting, but it's of little consolation to the people who are stuck beneath it at the moment with extraordinarily powerful winds still.
Yep. And those winds, because it's such a slow moving system, those winds are going to stay, you know, to bring further catastrophic damage to the island. That's what we're talking about, catastrophic damage, where buildings will be completely flattened along with the torrential rain we've got and the storm surge that's going to continue to feed in around this hurricane. So the problems for Grand Bahama are certainly not over by any stretch of the imagination. It's going to stay incredibly windy here for the next probably 24 hours or so, with just a gradual abatement of those strong winds.
And then the latest pictures I saw, it's going to take a path northwards, not directly over the coast of the eastern United States. Is that still correct?
Well, the problem is with these storms, because they become slow moving, they become quite uncertain. And you have to think about the scale as well of this storm system. We've talked about the location now being around Grand Bahama. Now, if you went 150 kilometres west, you'd come to West Palm Beach in Florida. where the winds at the moment are 45 kilometres an hour. So over the space of 150 kilometres, you're going from a wind speed that's, you know, quite a windy day, 45 kilometres an hour, not a problem, to something that's 300 kilometres an hour that will destroy your house. So that's the kind of scale we're looking at. So small deviations in these hurricanes could send that into the East Coast. As well as that, there are complicated dynamics in hurricanes where you can get eye wall replacement cycles. What that does is it means that the fluctuation in speed and the strength of the hurricane occurs, but at the same time, the wind field, the area of strong winds, can expand. So that could be something that actually takes some strong winds into Florida as well.
That was Chris Fawkes. After nine rounds of talks over the course of nearly a year, the American peace envoy to Afghanistan says the US and the Taliban have reached an agreement in principle. The plan involves the departure of around 5,000 American troops over the next few months. But even as those details emerged, the Taliban carried out another bomb attack in Kabul. If a ceasefire does lead to a final peace deal, it could end 18 years of a struggle between the Taliban and US-led forces that has cost tens of thousands of lives. Our correspondent Hugh Sykes has visited Afghanistan many times over those years. He used his archive to take us from the high optimism of late 2001 to alarm at the prospect of a return of the Taliban.
In the Afghan capital, Kabul, in December 2008, I wrote and recorded this.
The disconnect is between the immense international effort here, backed by thousands of foreign troops, and the facts on the ground. 30 million population, half of whom live below the poverty line of $2 a day. Severe food shortages because of a huge increase in the price of wheat flour.
Nearly 11 years later, I hardly have to change a word. More than half of Afghans now live below the poverty line, and food insecurity remains high. But in 2008, there was also tangible relief that the Taliban had been driven away and a determination never to let them come back. I heard this from people in a village.
I want from the, all of the people, the foreign people, to come in Afghanistan and to help Afghanistan.
So you like Americans, British, French?
Yeah, all of the people, of foreign people.
Who is the enemy?
My enemy is Taliban. They are fighting with the people of Afghanistan. They are not Muslim.
But I also heard a more accommodating opinion about the potential future role of the Taliban in Afghanistan from a man who was chopping wood by the roadside, ready to sell it to people for the winter.
The wood seller is Raz Mohammed. He condemns Taliban violence as un-Islamic, but he believes in talking to them. Yes, all Afghans should be in the government, he says. Everybody. That would bring us peace and stability. It's good to talk to the Taliban and give them their share.
And in a village to the west of Kabul, again in 2008, there was confidence at first about life being better now. But digging into some of the detail, there was also anxiety about the Taliban maybe coming back. And despite the cheerful laughter of the children who were following me around, their coats were thin, and they were shivering as the sun set beyond the snow-covered mountains.
Bulbul Shah.
Bulbul Shah, like the bird. His name is Bulbul Shah, and the children are all laughing because I've made wing-flapping gestures with my arms because Bulbul means nightingale. How is your life here, Bulbul Shah? Everything good?
We don't have electricity, that's the problem.
And security, how is security?
Security here in our village in Pagman is good, he says, but it's getting worse in other places. And we keep hearing about suicide bombs and car bombs. A year later, when violence was escalating and car bombs were becoming routine and concrete blast walls were going up in Kabul and President Obama was promising thousands more American troops for the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force, ISAF, the mood on the street was out of tune with the caged bird's cheerful song. Don't tell me your country's built roads and schools here, says this carpet seller, Muhammad Yunus. We had roads and schools in Afghanistan before. What we need now is jobs and business. I need customers for my carpets. You foreigners have turned us into beggars.
What optimism there was in the early days of liberation from the Taliban has slipped into dejection and despair, not only at the prospect of the Taliban returning in some form, but also at the failure of Afghan politicians to control a virus which has been relentlessly undermining the country's future, the virus of corruption.
That was Hugh Sykes reporting. Still to come on this podcast, why a new Chinese app with deep fake technology is considered more than just a bit of harmless fun. Opposition politicians in Israel have criticised Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for playing politics at the expense of security during an attack by the militant Lebanese Shia organisation Hezbollah. The BBC understands that Israel went to extraordinary lengths to pretend it had suffered casualties in the cross-border attack in order to convince Hezbollah that it had achieved its objective and end its operation. Wira Davis reports from Jerusalem.
For several days, Israel had been preparing for an attack from Lebanon after Hezbollah had warned it would retaliate for recent Israeli operations in Syria and Beirut. The BBC now understands that as Hezbollah fired rockets against Israeli positions on Sunday afternoon, Israel put into motion an elaborate plan to convince the Shia militia that it had inflicted several casualties. Israeli media reports said that two apparent victims were flown by helicopter from an army base to hospital. The soldiers were filmed, bloodied and bandaged, being loaded into waiting ambulances. But 2 hours later, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said there had in fact been no casualties, not even a scratch. The whole thing, it appeared, was a ruse to convince Hezbollah to end the attack, assuming its aims had been achieved. Hezbollah insisted there were casualties and accused Israel of lying. Israeli opposition leaders also criticised the government's apparent tactics, saying the Prime Minister was bragging about using psychological warfare in order to gain votes in the forthcoming elections.
Wira Davis reporting. Deep fake technology that can manipulate images and sounds to make people appear to do and say practically anything has been around for a while now. But there's been huge interest in recent days in a new Chinese app called Zhao that allows users to swap their faces with celebrities, sports stars and film and TV characters. It's also been accompanied by cries and concerns about what it means for privacy. I asked our Asia-Pacific editor, Michael Bristow, about the app's popularity.
You're right to say that these have existed for some time. They're around. I use them with my kids. They've got an app on their phone where they can make our faces look old or very, very young. Great fun. This app, though, is a little bit different, Zhao, because it's very, very good. If you see a person's face superimposed onto film stars, Leonardo DiCaprio, Marilyn Monroe, they're just two of the videos that people's faces can be uploaded onto. They're very, very good. Very, very good indeed. And so that's why this has caused such attention. That's why it's been the most downloaded app in China for the last couple of days, the most downloaded free app, even though there are a number of issues with it.
Yeah, you mentioned those issues. The issue of privacy, it's upset and made some users rather concerned about it.
It has. As you say, the privacy issue is important because initially, when the app came out, the developer said that any content created on it would be its property. So obviously that worried people that they were uploading things that they wouldn't then have control over it. Since then, the maker has come out and said, look, we will change our ways slightly. We'll adapt these rules. We're not going to use anything that we don't have an agreement with the user. So there has been some movement on that issue. There is a second issue, though, and perhaps a bigger issue, and that's about deep fake technology. This is using artificial intelligence to create videos which are just not true. And of course, when we see something, seeing is believing, that's what we all think. We believe it to be the truth, but this technology shows us that's not always the case. It has issues for people personally. You know, people could be accused of doing things or their images imposed in compromising situations. Also in politics, we could have politicians being shown to be saying things they haven't actually said. So lots of ramifications from this technology.
Michael Bristow. Politics and sport sometimes become uncomfortably entangled, so it's perhaps rather apt then that the latest example of that involves judo. Syed Molai, an Iranian competitor at the World Judo Championships in Japan, says he came under pressure from Tehran to throw a match so he wouldn't have to meet an Israeli in the final. Iran bars its athletes from competing with representatives of Israel. Pouria Jeffrey is sports reporter for the BBC's Persian service.
It's happened so many times before that Iranian wrestlers, football players, they have avoided facing Israeli opposition. But with judo 81 kilograms, the number one seed in the world is from Iran and the number two seed is from Israel. So they come across very often. And it happened in the Abu Dhabi Grand Prix, the Paris Grand Slam and in China. And the International Judo Federation was aware that something is going to happen in Tokyo. The Iranians, they took the risk to send him there in the first place, thinking that maybe the Israeli judo wrestler won't make it to the final. When it became evident that he's going to make it, there were a couple of phone calls, and this has all been documented now. Apparently, when those phone calls were made from the head of the Iranian Olympic Committee and also the deputy sports minister, the head of the International Judo Federation and officials were present, and he was told to make it look like he's put in an effort and he's lost it.
And specifically, there are allegations that there were threats made against his family as well.
Yeah, apparently people from the intelligence ministry have been present at his house and spoken to his dad and put pressure to give him a ring and ask him not to face Israeli opposition.
And what, if anything, have the Iranian authorities said? Have they made any comment?
Yeah, we just had a letter from the head of the Iranian Olympic Committee to the head of IOC, Thomas Bach. And he is saying that this was all a setup by the head of the International Judo Federation. And basically the reason that Syed Molai has lost the semifinal is because of what they've done to him. And like his mind was not in the right place before that bout.
So this unwritten law, if you like, from what you're saying, it's quite widespread that there's pressure put on athletes.
It goes back to 1983. I think it's a wrestling championship in Turkey where a Iranian wrestler did compete against an Israeli opponent. And then the whole team were asked to go back to Iran immediately. And after that, there was this unwritten code of conduct that they shouldn't face Israeli opposition.
What are people in Iran make of that? Are they fed up? Do they want politics and sport to be disentangled?
You know, when that wrestler Alireza Karimi went back to Iran, he was received by the supreme leader, and the supreme leader gave him one of his rings, which is one of the most prestigious things you can do to an Iranian citizen. But when it comes to, I'm going to quote Syed Molai in this case. He said he's had enough. He wanted to bring prestige for his country, and he was sure that he was not going to get the chance to go to Tokyo 2020 under the Iranian flag. And now what we have is the International Federation, Judo Federation, says that he will compete at the 2020 Olympics under the IOC flag in the refugee team.
That was Pouria Jeffrey of BBC Persian. Football is considered a sport accessible to anyone. All you need is a ball, two goalposts, and off you go. But what about a sport like polo? Well, you need a horse, a mallet, a team that plays the game, and money. Lots of it. In Nigeria, it's traditionally been something for the country's elite, but the sport is gaining in general popularity too, with big polo clubs in cities like Lagos and Kaduna. So why is the game known as the sport of kings so well liked there? Juliet Mafua of BBC Sport Africa reports.
It's fast, furious, and conceded to be a dangerous sport. Polo may not be as popular as football in Nigeria, but for some, it's the only sporting event worth being seen at. The games have an atmosphere of glitz and glamour, and the who is who of Nigeria attend. It's no wonder they call polo the sport of kings. First introduced to Nigeria by British naval officers in 1904, today there are 15 official polo clubs in Nigeria, from Lagos, Kaduna, Katsina and Port Harcourt. I'm at the 5th Chaka Polo Club in Kaduna in northwestern Nigeria. The polo club was founded in 2001 with over 300 stables. It hosts private polo tournaments and two annual polo championships.
The Fifth Charco is one of the major polo clubs in Nigeria and plays host to international professional polo players. The club is a social hotspot. Fans watch the game and some dine whilst the action is underway on the playing field. Polo is considered one of the most dangerous sports in the world. Even though the rate of injury is low, when it does occur, both players and horses are at risk of serious injury. Often the result of falls from the horse or collisions with other players or equipment. Abdurrahman Sirika is a professional polo player. He's from Rubicon Polo Team, a polo club based in Abuja, Nigeria's capital. Abdurrahman has been playing polo since he was a kid, but started professionally in 2011. He travels around the world, competing in tournaments. He explained the appeal of the game.
To be honest, I think it's the horses, for me personally, because they're wonderful creatures and my favorite animal.
Success on the field can be lucrative. Polo players in Nigeria earn about $3,000 per tournament, playing about four matches a week. But it's a sport only a few in the country can afford. Upkeep of the horses and stables are considerably high. That's for the maintenance of the stable, the groomsmen, a doctor on retainer, and vet bills. Horses often contract malaria, fever, colic, or get injured on the field. Aliu Mohammed works at the Kaduna Stables.
Polo game is a game of kings, and it's too expensive. If you want to buy a horse like Argentina, you'll buy some $15,000, some you get it $10,000, some $7,000. It depends on the highest quality that you get.
Polo is a sport synonymous with luxury, but that doesn't mean only the rich and famous love the game. It's slowly gaining popularity as a spectator sport in the country. Most of the major clubs in Nigeria now also own riding academies where they train hopeful riders to become professional players. This means that they can become professionals without having to travel abroad and are able to compete in major tournaments. Polo is now played in over 15 countries in Africa. The thrill of Choka, as it's known in Nigeria, is hooking people into the game and turning a niche sport into a popular one, enabling African polo clubs to become major players in the international game.
That was Juliet Mafua in Nigeria. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.